This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's conversant is Theo Jordan, who is an attorney in the fabulous state of Florida. He got into the business of pushing back against the ways in which the American population is being manipulated by the use or misuse of information. And while he is concentrating on some things that are pretty perturbing in present-day America and in our society, he kind of has a few white pills up his sleeve. So you can find links to his work down there in the description. Without further ado, here is Theo Jordan. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
I'm a computer information systems major, so it's a little embarrassing I had to ask you for the grandma walkthrough of how to change headphones. But
that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Boyce.
You're not a professional podcast host just quite yet.
That's right. That's right. Good evening, sir.
How are you?
I am fantastic. Had one of those chicken with my head cut off kind of days, but this is the highlight of my day, Mr. Boyce. Right, I woke up excited about conversation.
Oh, great. Good. Excellent. Wonderful. Because you are on a tear. You've been on a tear for a while now, a couple years now.
Right. Three plus straight, man. Daily grind.
Oh, okay. 3 years. So that lines up with 2021 then?
2020, about a week after the election. I decided to enter the fray, and I think I've written almost 300,000 posts since that time.
Okay.
It's a big number. But that number is a little skewed because I retweet quite obsessively, and okay, it counts every one of those. So I don't think I've written 300,000 posts.
Well, I mean, but, and they're sentences. They're not like full-on blog articles or amicus briefs, right?
But yeah, it's been a hell of a grind, man. And you know what I find so fascinating about it, Benjamin, is I've never run out of fuel. It's like every single day, my gases feel more fired up and more nitro than they were before. And I know that sounds a little cheesy, but the way I interpret it is, even though I'm not a destiny guy, it's feedback that I'm on the path I'm supposed to be. I'm doing the right thing. Yep. And that's why no matter how much energy I use, there's more to fill it in.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm glad to have you back on. We spoke, I think it was about a year ago, maybe a little bit more. And you were at a particular point. Well, the whole world was at a particular point back then. So things have changed, but I kind of like to meet back up with people and like see how they develop, see how they've honed their skills, see if they've their perspective on what they're doing or what's going on has kind of fundamentally shifted at all.
Great question. And quickly, thank you very much for having me back on. For anybody who may not be familiar, Benjamin reached out to me when, goodness, man, I'm not sure I had 400 or 500 followers on Twitter, DM'd me one night and asked if I'd be interested in coming on a show. Little did he know I'd been following him since before I had an account. And it was very flattering to me and was really the start of what lit a fire that's burning heavier today. And answer your question. So thank you, Benjamin. I appreciate you sharing your project with me or having me be part of it. I don't think things have changed much in terms of the global perspective, the societal meltdown that is fueling my efforts. But my own journey has changed significantly, and I tip my hat to you for that. That invite you sent me was a realization that what I was doing intellectually could compete on the global stage. I know that's kind of a dramatic statement for a direct message from
you.
Benjamin
saying you're
Boyce.
Going toe to toe with Schwab?
Yeah, I would clown Schwab, but I mean that sincerely. You were a voice I looked up to a lot, a mind I looked up to a lot. The people on your show were just the heart of the sphere that I was enamored with. And when you said, hey, Theo, I want you on my stage, it was a revelation for me of like, okay, I can do this too, you know? And I don't mean to make it seem like I was overly humble prior to that, but I didn't have any sense that the thoughts I was having, the analysis I was providing was something that could compete at that highest level. Mm. And when you reached out to me, it was like, okay, don't be intimidated by that concept. And I think it took me 8 months to agree to come on. Bless your heart, you reached out to me again. But anyways, at that time, as I think I told you that night, I didn't have any plans on doing anything. I bought this mic to speak with you. And I really enjoyed that experience. It did truly lit a fire. And so I have been playing around with, and I won't plug my own stuff, but I've been playing around with audio projects ever since.
Okay.
What'd you say? I'm sorry.
No, you can absolutely plug yourself. I'm interested in what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate
while we talk
it.
So, about what it is, like the content.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started a Substack page when I first got suspended on Twitter. I got hit with a 24 hours a long time ago. And I thought, okay, it's only a matter of time until I get silenced.
What did you do? Do you even remember?
I was actually, I dropped a pretty nasty F-bomb at someone. The first one was arguably warranted.
Okay.
Now, they had said post-election that basically all of us that were Trump supporters deserved to be like gulagged, basically. So I think what they said was much worse. But I probably put it in some cruder language than they did. So I didn't mind the first hit.
Yeah.
I learned a little lesson there, that there's a way you can tell someone off without flagging flags.
Yeah.
So I went and created a Substack page really just to use as an email database. And I even said that on the page. So I'm not writing here. I just, you know, I have energy behind me. I want to bring it here in case I get cut off at the bird. And about 8 or 9 months went by. I never wrote anything on it. And people would just sign in, which I appreciate. It was like a fallback list if I got silenced. And then in January of last year, this is an interesting little story. I was talking with somebody in my replies who is not trans. And in fact, they were not arguing with me about this issue. And I was focusing in, I wrote a tweet about this 30 minutes ago. I was focusing in on the term that we hear a lot. You don't want us to exist. Okay. Yeah. And I was just simply talking about the notion that they already do exist as people. And what that question actually means is you must bow down to our dogma and participate in our role play. And if that's the case, then no, you cannot exist. Okay. So this guy, reasonable guy, says back to me, he's like, you are saying the rhetoric that is causing us so much harm. This is not helpful and blah, 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 blah. So I simply said back to him, I said, look, there's a critical difference in maintaining gender dysphoria as a mental health status versus this gender theory where, you know, Leah Thomas actually is a female. And this is the sentence that got me suspended. I said, the reality is gender dysphoria is a mental health disorder as defined in the DSM-5. That was it. I believe that would be a statement of objective fact, by the way.
Yeah.
And I got nailed. About an hour later, my account was suspended. I don't think it was my third strike. They gave me a chance to delete it, but I decided I wasn't going to because I wasn't deleting a statement of fact. And as it stands today, I would not be on Twitter if not for Rabbit Hole doing me a solid, which I don't need to describe, but Rabbit Hole is the reason I'm back on Twitter.
Okay.
He pulled a string for me. So anyhow, it was in this about 2 or 3 week period that I was completely cut off from Twitter before Rabbit pulled his rabbit out of his hat for me. I was writing exclusively on Twitter, on Substack, and I was almost using it like Twitter. I was doing short stuff. I was doing long stuff. And man, I was getting 1,000, 2,000, couple days, 4,000 or 5,000 traffic or hits there. And I'm like, this is cool. I'm creating my own baby. And then I got let back into Twitter, and it was like, my principles just went away. Woohoo! You know, I ran back into the bird party. And I neglected Substack terribly. 2 or 3 months went by, I'd barely written a thing. And I'm like, man, that's not right. Because these 500 or 1,000 people have joined me over there. Those are people who are really putting their weight behind my efforts. And for me to be neglecting them, I just felt really guilty about it. Yeah. So I changed my approach and decided I'm going to really start building my own baby on Substack. Then I got an email one day or a message from the site, and it said, so-and-so, one of your members, would like to be a paid subscriber. They've already signed up for it, but you don't offer paid memberships. If you click this button and turn them on, they will be your first sign up, blah, blah, blah. And to be honest with you, Benjamin, I had never wanted to monetize because I feel like once you start selling coffee mugs, you're put in a different bucket, whether that's fair or not. And I think my energy has built on the digital realm out of a sense of authenticity or a sense of trustworthiness, a sense that I'm not pushing bullshit for my own self-interest.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to monetize at all. And in fact, I told my wife that story. I'm like, I'm not going to click it. I just don't want to be the grifter guy. And she's like, she talked me out of it. She's like, number one, you're an idiot to walk away from money. But number two, how do you know there aren't other people who would also be paid subscribers, but they don't have the boldness to send you a message in advance? So, and I'll end the story. I know I'm rambling on you, but
that's fine.
So I turned it on. And I got, I don't know, 12 or 15 people that signed up pretty quick, maybe 20. It was really cool. I was really flattered by that, but I felt guilty because I wasn't doing anything for them that you couldn't get for free. And I didn't, you know, they didn't do it in consideration for something in return, but it just felt weird. So the idea I came up with was, I don't want to cut off my writings because the primary goal here is still to get the message out and counter the Truman Show, like we talked about last time. But I want to try to do something else. I think this is half midlife crisis, half a sense that I've found my calling and what my skill set is adapted to do, and half a sense that I'm helping save the West, like a true drive of you need to be doing this.
Yeah.
So I've decided I want to spend this next year, 2024, seeing if I can bridge this into being doing media like this full time and being a lawyer on the side, flipping my current life around. And the way I'm trying to build that is I'm building audio projects in my Substack, conversations I'm doing with people, these rants I do on the mic, a couple different projects. And in order to get access to them, you have to be a paid member. So that's the only thing I'm going to wall off because it's too contrary to my mission. And I recognize that making people pay for content probably means my model will never be successful because there's a million people you can listen to for free. But I figure if I ever get there, I've gotten there for the long term. I've built a pipeline. It's sustainable. So that's kind of the track I'm on. And all of that has happened since we chatted last November.
I guess I should ask this before or after the interview, but because it makes sense and you brought it up, are we showing your, are we revealing your face yet?
No, sir. If you would not mind, I am still
worried about. That's fine. So you're just like, but you're fine with your oral influence permeating through the cloud.
I love my oral influence.
That's where.
Yeah, you know, I think I have a somewhat recognizable voice, and I think I'm flirting closer and closer to these worlds colliding. Yeah. I've had several people connect the dots in my real life and figure out that I am Theo. And I had my first real life interaction where I was chatting with somebody in the real world and Theo Jordan came up. It was absolutely mind blowing for me. And
were you clocked at that point, or was it just like somebody brought up this person that you play on the
internet? We were talking about social issues and somehow James came up and we were talking about James Lindsay and some of his work. And then he dropped my name and it was bizarre. But I think that is going to, and I think they're going to cross eventually, but I'm going to try to maintain it as long
like,
as I can.
Like you're so Bruce Wayne and somebody's like, the Batman is running about town with the Flash.
It was really weird.
The other day.
I wanted to be like, I am him. it was pretty wild, man. So yeah, still staying anonymous. I work in a field that people could hurt.
You brought up the notion of authenticity, wanting to be authenticity, and you contrasted that with monetization, and you kind of laid out your thoughts on that. But authenticity is like a teenage thing. It's like, who am I? I need to be the authentic self. I mean, I guess, you know, midlife crisis, you know, the man who like wants to buy a new car or a new girlfriend or become the girlfriend by spending all that money he would have spent on his car on his own body. You know, which is a totally fine and legit way of men having a crisis right now around authenticity. That's one thing. But is there not an obligation, like the weight of what you're doing? Like, do you feel obligated to speak? And if so, why? What is the obligation? What is the obligation to? Saving the West is fine. I want something more specific, though.
Sure, absolutely. So first, just to slightly tweak the authenticity, I meant that in terms of really credibility. Yeah. That I trust that this person's post is authentic and they're not selling me a brand. To be honest with you, the drive built for me initially because of the dichotomy between living in Florida and what was happening nationally. So I felt almost a national duty to help wake the other 49 states up to, guys, what you're being told is not true. And we're not living like this at all. You're told you can't leave your house. You're going to die. We just hosted a Super Bowl, no masks. So that was largely the fuel source. But there was a personal incident that rose this to the level of obligation and duty for me. And that was my daughter, who is everything to me, daddy's little girl. And she was in second grade and my brother or her brother had just been born. He's an infant. And we're sitting at home one day and she, mind you, I'm in Florida. I'm in the best county in Florida for schools. And I'm in a really good school inside my county. Not by chance, we moved here for these purposes. But my point is, even within three layers of fortification from this crazy leftist stuff that's taken over our schools, my daughter comes home one day and we're not talking about anything having to do with this. We're chilling in our living room. And out of the blue, she says to me, Daddy, is my brother not a boy or a girl? And she said it's stupid, like they might ask about a chocolate chip cookie monster or something, right? So I just scoffed it off. I was like, no, silly, of course he's a boy. What else would he be? And Benjamin, without blinking an eye, she says, that fish that can change from a girl to a boy? And dude, it was like, my ears went up. Yeah. It's like, okay, clownfish. So somebody's talking about the clownfish to my daughter, right? what else are they talking about? The gender unicorn, the gingerbread man, where is this coming from? So I reached out to Billboard Chris because I was really struggling with it. Okay, somebody's painting my daughter's mental canvas. I don't want them to put the first brush strokes on, but I don't want to be the person who seeds this crap into their mind either. I would prefer my 7-year-old daughter to live life without thinking about this crap, but it seemed too late. So I reached out to Billboard Chris, who's a wonderful guy, and he spent some time in direct message, giving me some good advice on how he approached his daughters. And I started sort of an initiative with my daughter of speaking about some things, being very aware to what she said, countering things I could see she was adopting. And I guess my point in sharing that story, I would later find out it was amusing. I didn't make a big deal of it. I didn't even bring it up right away. I just started slowly molding her myself. And she's doing wonderful. She's actually more girly today than she's ever been. I don't have any problems of losing her to this Franken feminist crazy stuff. But I think that story made me realize that no matter how secluded you feel, no matter how safe you feel in all these boundaries in Florida and this great county, this stuff is everywhere. And I don't think I could have protected my daughter more than I have. And yet there it was in her face. And Benjamin, if she doesn't have a good dad who's aware of this stuff and turning to Billboard Chris and talking to her and a great mom, and we give her this great foundation, who's painting that canvas? Where does she turn to with that confusion? She goes back to the music teacher who pulls out the gingerbread man.
Yeah.
So I think it was landing on my front porch made me realize, okay, I'm not just helping save the West in this ethereal battle on Twitter, but holy cow, man, this stuff is in my own neighborhood and we need to fight back. And so, yeah, I do feel a duty. I mean, this will sound like a stupid statement, but Alex Jones, who I'm not a fan of, but he has a show forever, Information Wars. And I have absolutely come to realize that he was decades ahead on that. And he's right. We are in an information war. I'm not sure it's not already a World War III pitting governments against their own citizens rather than armies on a field of battle. And if you look at it that way, I mean, not to pound my chest here and put on like a, you know, suit of armor here and act like I'm tough. But I think those of us who are fighting this are largely serving a national duty in that regard. I mean, there is like an information war going on, and I do feel a sense of duty in that vein.
So this overlaps with a lot of my own story and how I got into it and what I've come across and the different layers of analysis for it. So you have your framework is this thing called the Truman Show. And yes, we spoke about it a bit. I wonder if you could, you can describe that again. And then, cause I'm really interested in different layers of critique about it. And, sure, you know, I have James on, but I also talk to people from a wide variety of political analyses. And I don't know exactly where I find myself, but I do like to be kind of always the critic of everything just to see how it ticks. I just like to see how it ticks. Like, so what's the Truman Show? How does it tick?
Sure. So the Truman Show obviously is ripping off the name of the movie. Great movie. If anybody hasn't seen this, you should go watch it with Jim Carrey. The 30-second synopsis is they birth a child, Truman, into a completely artificial world. But you'd never know because the Truman world looks like a Pleasantville. It's this perfect world with lots of people, whole city, schools, the whole nine. And they've birthed this child, a baby, into it, who obviously is born within this artificial realm. So the baby thinks it's the real world, but it's actually a huge reality TV show. And all the people from the real world are watching. There's cameras everywhere and everybody in the city are actors, whatever. You can see where the script goes. So I use that as an analogy to our current times, where the Inflation Reduction Act is the largest climate spending bill in history. Natural immunity has become a conspiracy theory, saying that the virus from Wuhan probably came from the biolab doing gain of function research on those viruses in Wuhan is racist, says the New York Times. So we're living in this very upside down world. Shit, I wrote a thread this morning about immigration. CNN has flipped the script in 24 hours. They are now parroting the propaganda that the Democratic Party is trying to solve the border and the Republicans are stifling it.
Okay.
I mean, talk about an example of the Truman Show.
Well, we were
waiting
for something to come down because all that stuff happened with Texas and then the state started aligning. And I would like to get more into this with you because I know you have more of a head for the legal aspects of this. I'm just assuming. But but there was no response. And you're like, well, you know, they're cooking up. It's like it was deafening. It's like everybody's waiting for the orders to come down, but nobody had orders. So they're waiting. Now they're finally having orders. So now they can start to write about the crisis. But before that, they weren't even covering it.
No, nothing's being covered. Exactly. And the article I read on CNN today, Swalwell, of course, his quote in there was like, well, clearly the Democrats are for the fix and the Republicans are just for the frustration or something like that. And I'm reading these quotes like, my goodness, how disconnected from reality do you have to be for this to make any sense? You know, the bill that he's proposed that says he can shut down the border once the traffic gets high. High is specifically mentioned in the bill as 5,000 a day. That's 1.825 million per year. That is a level of crisis that they're setting as an acceptable benchmark for when we won't close it down. Insane. So great example of the Truman Show. And I use that term constantly to refer to a web of media, political, institutional, and social cultural capture that has occurred that has driven us to such a level that the Major League Baseball, MLB League can move their all-star game because of Jim Crow 2.0 voting right things, but yet move it to a state that has stricter voting rights, right? Black Lives Matter in the NBA, they shut down their season, all this crazy stuff for a whole summer. What did they do in the end? They met with Obama for a midnight meeting, set up a get out the vote effort for the DNC the next morning, and got the season back on track. Nothing for police brutality, nothing for the black community, nothing. It all went through Act Blue. It's for the Democrats. So I use it to talk about that web. And the reason I'm using web is, I'll be honest, Benjamin, I haven't figured out how expansive this web is. I'm still not 100% sold that Donald Trump isn't part of the hijinks meant to take this populist movement forming on the right and march it off a cliff. So while I talk a lot in left-right binary, blue and red,
all right,
I'm not as rigid on that as a lot of people may think.
Interesting. Okay, great. Okay. So are you aware of, I'm going to bring up a guy, Curtis Yarvin's work. He has another word for it. It's called the cathedral. And he analyzes, you know, this education, media, government complex that is an oligarchy of unaccountable bureaucrats who actually are the ones who are making all the laws and all the policies, and they're the ones who write them all and then give them to our elected leaders who then just sign them off. So I'm just wondering, having spoken about issue after issue after issue, if you kind of have, and even if you don't know how far it goes, if you kind of understand where it comes from, do you have like a mythos for it yet? Like a kind of like a plot arc for this thing?
Yes.
Is it
no.
aligning interests? You know, it's just a bunch of self-aligning interests. It just took this form or what?
Well, I've had that conversation with several people that I admire a lot intellectually. And there is a sizable camp amongst, I don't know, the folks that I roundtable this kind of stuff with, who are against the notion of there being a shadowy cabal that is running the global capture, right? And what they will typically present to me, and particularly this was about COVID, but I think it applies beyond that, is that what it was a series of bumbling errors and selfishness, useful idiots taking advantage of situations, and that it is a conglomerate of a whole bunch of unethical, selfish acts that became this totality of like dominance, right? I reject that theory. I think the synergy of everything, the way it all came down in concert across the entire West, particularly the G7, could not have happened without high-level coordination. Let's step away from COVID to answer that question and go over to gender and queer plus for a second. The notion that, you know, 1,000% increases of children finding their true selves because they were born in the wrong body is sprouting up from Canada to Australia to Croatia to England to America simultaneously in an organic fashion, there's just no way. And the obsession with queer plus, gender spirits, inclusivity, all the DEI cult creeds that are completely weaved in the UN, UNESCO, the World Health Organization, all those NGOs, that's where the cathedral is. It's in the NGOs. I ignorantly didn't recognize the name you said because I've ignorantly always thought the cathedral was a brainchild of Michael Malice. And now I realize how stupid that is. But every time I've heard the cathedral mentioned, his name's come up. I'm not super familiar with Michael. But I'm very familiar with the concept. And let me throw one more on the table that I think shows we clearly have a cathedral or at least a deep state in America. And that is when you go back and look at the Russiagate era and the interference with Peter Stroyeck and the FBI. When he texts his mistress that he's banging, also FBI staffer, and she says, Donald Trump's not going to become president, is he? And he writes back, no, we won't let him. Or no, we will stop it, he says. We will stop it. Who is we at that point? Because that's our FBI. The one in office at that time, the executive, assumably the boss of those branches, was Donald Trump. But we have an FBI who's actively working to remove Donald Trump. So you have to ask yourself, who is the FBI working for? when Austin, our head of Department of Defense, went to the hospital for 2 weeks and Joe Biden wasn't even informed? Who's running our military? So for those who think it's a series of bumbling, tiny connections that added up to a greater machine of no design, who's pulling those strings? If Biden's not being informed of the military, right? If the FBI is working against the president, there has to be some sort of shadowy cabal that is directing those actions. Do you think that's a statement of fact, or is that my own theory?
Well, I think it's very useful, but I can't discount the likelihood or the possibility that it's this organism has so much inertia to it that all of the leadership decayed through it, and it's kind of like a dinosaur that doesn't know it's dead. It's just kind of following through on this kind of automatic processes. And it's showing signs of life by adopting something that kind of is a previous version of itself, like DEI is the ghost of the civil rights era, right? So it's got like this kind of like these virtues that it's signaling, but they're all dead and they aren't serving anything other than just restaffing it with people who think the right way and who can fill out the right kind of jobs, which would be not innovation seekers, just a bunch of midwits who can shuffle the paper around and follow orders kind of in a kind of Longhausian, there's no leadership, but everybody's kind of waiting for like, okay, the idea is going to concentrate around these ideas. So I don't know, because if you look at the, if it is a shadowy cabal, where are the effective players?
Whistleblowers.
Yeah. Whistleblowers. And like, cause they're all incompetent. Like, it's grossly incompetent.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yeah, that's an interesting way. I love the way you describe those movements sort of being this almost zombie-like corpse that's moving forward, but they no longer possess the same body. As you're saying that, I'm thinking of the gay rights movement. I'm thinking of the feminist movement. I'm thinking of the civil rights movement. I'm thinking about the abortion movement. I'm thinking about every one of the big progressive movements are now hollowed out completely and all wearing queer plus revolution skin. It's crazy.
Yeah.
One of the things that was mind-blowing for me, a couple weeks ago, I was reached out to by a reporter in Croatia who's got a podcast, Andre. Yeah, awesome guy.
Really?
Wanted me to come on a show. Hold on 1 second. I want to give his correct name while I'm chatting here. So he reached out to me about coming on his show, and it had been an invite from months ago. I just didn't see it because we weren't following each other on Twitter. Whatever. Long story short, we had a chat, private chat. The only way to go on a show was in person, and I wasn't willing to do that. Really appreciated the invite. So he and I just did a private chat, didn't record or anything. Stayed up till like 2 o'clock in the morning the other night chatting with this gentleman. He told me, and I finally pulled his name up. His name is Andrea Klarik, K-L-A-R-I-C. His first name is A-N-D-R-I-J-A underscore Klarik, K-L-A-R-I-C on the bird. Anyhow, he's a kind of an indie reporter over in Croatia who has now scored himself a small TV show and has an audience of 1 million. There's only 4 million citizens over there. So I was very interested to chat with him. And the only reason I'm sharing this story is, number one, we were cut from the same stone. This gentleman was older than me. He had served in their army. He had fought in their Croatian wars that they had. He has been around Zelensky and Kiev. He had a lot of interesting insight. He was living a life that had nothing to do with any of this prior to 2020. Now this work has darn near consumed his life. Bing, I relate to this. He told me about this business he ran, and then the company got taken over, or the country got taken over by communism. They basically came to him and said, you're going to take out this loan from the government. He realized that he was signing away his freedom. So he gave them his whole business and walked away. And that revealed to him the horrors of communism. He then started a gym franchise. He built individual gyms. He's done quite well for himself. That's what he is now, as a gym owner. And in 2020, he started noticing, particularly around COVID, that his country was transforming before his eyes. What the media and government were telling him contradicted what was happening on the ground. And he started writing on Twitter, writing on a blog, and it's grown ever since. I mean, this guy's story resonated with me so much. It's like we had walked the same path. The reason I'm bringing it up in the context right now is one of the last questions I asked Andrea is, I said, tell me, because he also talked, Benjamin, about the social stuff, queer plus, gender spirits, all this shit taking over Croatia, right? So I asked him, I said, what was the messaging like from your government, your Truman Show? What were they blasting you with? Was it, you'll kill grandma? Thank goodness I had two shots. Now my symptoms are mild. And I went down like the 6 or 7 call signs of this leftist doctrine. He said to me, every single one, Theo, same program here is running there. Yeah. And it was a bone chilling moment for me where I went, okay, this capture of the West is even worse than I appreciated because this is Croatia. Right. So when I lay stories like that on the table, the Hunter Biden laptop, the Aspen exercise where they told the media how to prepare for that, when I start laying all these things on the table, I just personally, I don't think you can come away with the conclusion that there's not a high level operative. But I'm always quick to qualify everything I say with that's my take. I could be wrong.
OK, well, you know, I don't, whether or not it's accurate or true, it's your working hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So if it is true, or to the extent that you believe that it's true, you're acting on that information. How are you acting? What is the proper, how have you, what tools is it? Is it just pure information? You just like, you do counter narrative?
Yes, I think we are currently in the stage of still spreading awareness. And I know that it's frustrating as hell because we're now pushing into 2024. I think there is a sense of those who don't know basic truths now, like the basic truths around COVID and the laptop and, you know, some of these immigration, some of these critical stories, they don't want to. It's not a matter of they can't get the info. They can. They're intentionally siloing themselves from it. So to some extent, I think we will reach a saturation point where it's like we are now wasting our efforts trying to wake people up. And in fact, we're giving life to the crazy. The more we highlight the crazy on Twitter, the more the crazy grows. So eventually I will pull away from that strategy, and I get hammered by my followers a lot of like, why do you keep highlighting this crazy shit? Let it die. The problem is, Benjamin, I can retweet something I wrote a year and a half ago and it'll get a ton of clicks at night and all these people going, oh my God, have you never seen this? And these are our followers.
Yeah. Okay.
So what's the information saturation in the dark blue silos? So in answer to your question, I am still in full bore, push back against the propaganda, spread awareness. Okay. Because I wrote a piece on Substack recently called The Web of Lies, and it just walked down all these layers of propaganda and then showed some examples of what it's doing to people. You know, the hate craft, like you're it's unsafe to come to Florida if you're gay. This is the state of Art Deco in South Beach and Fantasy Fest. There's the Truman Show. Excuse me. So I don't know. I lost my chain of thoughts. I got thinking about Jason, who you had on recently, because I thought you were about to ask me, who do I think is ultimately on those? Who's controlling it at the higher level?
Yeah.
And I don't know those answers. I don't spend a lot of time on those answers because I feel like they're way above my pay grade. If little Theo, the attorney in Florida, was able to figure out who was controlling the Truman Show, then I shouldn't be practicing law in a state in Florida. I should be like James Bond for the world, right? So I feel like that project's above my pay grade and there's other people who are on it. My role is spreading information. But if I had to, gun to my head, come up with a theory who's doing this all, I'd point you to Jason's videos. Yeah. I'd point you to those videos that go back over a century. I'd point to the creations of Planned Parenthood, the UN, the UNESCO, the World Health Organization, all of the NGOs that have now formed this web that is clearly designed for global capture. And in my opinion, it's driving us towards equity, which is a fancy name for communism, but we won't go too far.
You said dark blue silos. Is that what does that refer to?
I just use dark blue as a term to mean like super left. So silos that are so blue, there's no red getting in them anymore.
Okay. All right.
And Swalwell.
Hatecraft is another one of your coinages. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so I was always fascinated with the term racecraft. And I forget where that came from. I think somebody wrote a book. But I think it took on a social meaning outside of whoever the creators of that were. And I think racecraft really popped out. Well, obviously, it really popped out in 2020. And a great example of racecraft would be the LA Times saying that Larry Elder is the black face of white supremacy. Like, that just doesn't make any sense. What do you mean, the black face of white supremacy? So racecraft, in my opinion, was a wizard-like spell book of language manipulation and weaponized empathy, emotional abuse propaganda to get people to bow down to your agenda, wrapping it under the idea that this is all about end hate, end racism, right? Anti-racist doctrine has nothing to do with ending racism. In my opinion, its goal is to inflame racism at the individual level in order to build support for policies of equity. So I was playing around with this idea of racecraft for a long time. Playing around is the wrong way. I was seeing it everywhere. I'm like, wow, this racecraft is crazy. Then around 2022, it started to change flavors. I think to some extent, the racecraft got oversaturated. A lot of it just didn't make sense anymore because they got really carried away. Suddenly, black Republicans are white adjacent. It just doesn't make any sense. So I noticed that that exact same method of attack, method of intellectual attack and coercion, was being deployed all over the place. One of the greatest examples was, again, Hillary Clinton, the Human Rights Commission, the NAACP saying that blacks and gays are unsafe in Florida. But the NAACP chairman lives in Tampa. We have Fantasy Fest in the Keys. They all vacation down here for spring break, but you're putting out travel advisories that it's unsafe for people to come down here. So that's when I evolved this idea of it's not racecraft. It's the same method of attack mixed into all these various versions of hate. Like, whatever the equity troop wants to advance, they protect with this aura of hate. You can't speak against it or it's hate, right? But you can call me a white supremacist or a Nazi or a conspiracy theorist or an anti-vaxxer, all these really ugly terms that are just as offensive to me as groomer or lesbian, right? But all of a sudden in the UK, you can be charged if you call someone a lesbian because it's hate. So hatecraft is a manipulative...
Wait. Hold on. I'm sorry. Lesbian is a bad word now?
In the UK, there was a 16-year-old autistic girl who had a police officer show up at her house. She was real butchy looking. She looked like a lesbian. And the 16-year-old autistic girl, and of course, autistic people have a tendency to speak what's on their mind very bluntly, said, all she said, you look like a lesbian. My opinion, statement of objective fact, she was criminally charged.
Yeah.
Criminally charged for a valid observation, a 16-year-old autistic girl. That's weird because I'm not going to swear in your program, but I could call her a fat B, an ugly MF-er. I mean, I can come up with some horrible words, the C word. Women hate being called the C word, right? I can drop some nasty, nasty words of fire at that person. None of them trigger these hate laws, but I call her a lesbian, put me in cuffs. I mean, if people don't see the problem there, man, wake up. Okay. So going back to hatecraft, that I think that is sort of a general definition for this apparatus. And when you understand, and I don't mean the people listening, I think us and Twitter are the ones who have kind of solved this. But when one understands that method of attack, you can truly see it deployed even in places it really shouldn't be. Vaccine activism. That was a form of hatecraft. We'll kill grandma. We want people to die. No, I didn't want people to die. My whole family had the virus 2 weeks ago and we were fine. I obviously don't need the shots. But you see, if absent the hatecraft, you have to engage on the nuts and bolts. You need to explain to me why I need the shot. Well, they weren't able to do that. So what they deployed was, you won't take the shot and you're going to kill grandma. Hatecraft, man. Vaccine activism.
Okay. And do you think that that will reach a supersaturation point like with the racecraft? Or how has that progressed over time? Can they keep on doing it over and over again, which they do. I just want to hear more examples of it.
Sure. So let's talk about the elephant in the room then. I think this is probably a good segue for that. Let's talk about October 7th. Because, and I don't mean the event itself. I mean, what did hatecraft look like on October 6th? And what has hatecraft looked like on October 8th forward? So if we go back to the before times of October 6th, 2023, and every day before, hatecraft was firing at an immense level across our country, across damn near every left or progressive agenda in particular. If you look at our universities, the hatecraft was immense, man. I just wrote a thread about Harvard a couple weeks ago, and I started the thread with a scholarly journal from them in 2002. That's 22 years ago. The title of it was Abolishing the White Race. I cited another one where it was Whiteness is Property. The more I dug, the more I found. And that is 22 years ago. So for example, one of these billionaires who just announced they're pulling $300 million from, I think it was Princeton, went off on this tirade about, you know, oh, they're doing all this evil stuff and DEI's poison and all this. And in my opinion, Benjamin, that gentleman was not unaware of that in the before times. He just didn't have a problem with who the monster was eating. And on 10-7, the Frankenstein returned back home to eat its master. And when that happened, everything changed. Because, number one, the level of horror that everybody saw in 10-7 was a world-changing moment. I had seen that level of horror 10 or 15 years ago with ISIS, but I had to seek it out in dark pockets of the internet for the first time ever the world saw. And it was horrific. Those are sights that you can't unsee. From that moment on, I think Hatecraft has taken on a different character. And I think the apparatus in terms of being a successful political tool is failing rapidly. And that's because this rabid animal that was this Frankenstein that was created locked into a cause that became counter the agenda that was running. Now we have rabid protesters outside of DNC headquarters. Now we have Palestine-wrapped crazy people in San Francisco meetings chanting like cult members. You look around the room, they're all white. They're all queer plus. I don't know what it has to do with Palestine. Doesn't have much to do with Palestine at all.
Yeah.
So the answer to that question is, I don't think Hatecraft has much life left in American society because the ruse of it was greatly exposed on 10-7. It made everybody realize, I use the term all the time, the moral versus the monsters. Everything's been greased with that, particularly from the left. Critical thinking was shut off because on every topic, we're the moral, they're the monsters. You don't have to think anymore, right?
Yeah,
talked about that
okay.
with vaccines a second ago.
Yeah.
10-7 was a game changer there. I think the notion of the moral versus the monsters shattered the week after that with the response of Claudine Gay and those presidents, the protests on campus. I think it was a mass awakening of, oh, we don't have a good guy and a bad guy in America. And I don't want the right to now become the good guy. I want no more moral versus the monsters. Because once that framing is gone, Benjamin, Hatecraft can no longer operate. It requires that framework to be effective.
And what does it do to its wielders?
I am so concerned about that. So let's put a sympathetic hat on for a second. I love trashing this leftist movement because I want to see it go away. But the reality is these are millions of our own citizens. I think the number seven figures, it could be six figures that are truly lost in this, true believers. I think it's probably in a seven figure number. So I'm concerned for two reasons. Number one, what happens to the mental state of these folks? Like that's largely what my piece Web of Lies is about. Like I show a couple examples, like what's the off ramp for this person? And if our media wasn't continuing to lie to them, there might be an off ramp. But you look at COVID, for example, they're still pushing all the hysteria that got them there full bore. So unless they're like snapping out and reading Theo Jordan on Twitter, they're not even getting the information to get out. So I'm a little bit worried there's no off-ramp mentally. Sadly, not to be a doomer, I think we're going to have a lot more Nashvilles. I think a lot of these folks are going to snap and commit public acts of violence. I'm very afraid of a wave of public acts of violence from individual people who just break. I think churches are going to be targeted. We're already seeing that in Canada. So the mental wall is very concerning to me. But from the sympathetic card, I'm worried about what these people's lives on paper look like. And what I mean by that is, let's take somebody who studied gender theory, and I know it's an easy bash, I could use some other ones too, but what career path is there for somebody with a gender studies degree? They could teach it, they can indoctrinate the next wave coming down the assembly line. Other than that, what do they do with that degree? So one of the top issued degrees for, I think it was 10 or 15 years running, was DEI-based degrees. DEI has been captured in full by this decolonizing ideology, and I won't get into that, but there are stamps that present very clearly, settler colonial language, the pronouns, the septum ring. So a lot of stamps here, the oppressive rhetoric. As an employer, and I am, I run a law firm, if I saw a resume and it had those flags, or somebody walked in and was wearing that as the book cover, we're done, man. Water leak in the basement. Sorry you came. You know, so what happens to those people? If you've branded your whole life around DEI and inclusivity and, you know, all this decolonization crap, and you've got fingerprints of it all over the digital realm for the rest of your life, you've invested everything you have in these mythological secular gods that progressives came up with. And when those no longer have value in society, where do you turn? So I've been using the term online, the lost generation, which I'm sure you know from Japan. Yeah. And it was a different factors that led to their lost generation, but they literally experienced an entire demographic of theirs that just got left out to sea with no paddle and no sail. And I'll be honest, I think the Rainbow Guard in America, and I don't mean gay people here, I mean queer plus revolutionaries, are going to be America's lost generation. I've almost gotten to a point mentally that I don't think it's salvageable. And I don't say that happily, like, ha ha ha, destruction to them. No, these are kids, man.
Yeah.
These are Americans, right?
That lost generation, was that the, you said Japan, but wasn't there one in China as well? Like the, all the Red Guard got cut out?
Yeah, I think so. Exactly. Had like ideological zombies that were lost. Japan's, I think, was related to age. I don't think it was like social engineering that went awry. I'm not super familiar with it, but I think it had to do with like a demographic shakeout that just left them with like, not enough workers, you know, and they had a group that just were lost.
There was
I don't see how we don't have the same.
Yeah. There was this, I was on Twitter and there was a trending thing is Chicago City Council. And I go over to it and I see all these videos of the Chicago City Council voting 24 to 23 to renounce Israel for its war, which is okay. But if you look at Chicago, like how many deaths per day, per year happening there? And they don't want to deal with that. These people who are like gung-ho to tell Israel what to do, then I don't know where you stand on that issue. It's beyond me. But
it's beyond me too.
They have no desire to like fix the stuff in their own backyard.
Of course. We saw the same thing in San Francisco at that city council. Same resolution, Benjamin. They proposed,
really?
We denounce the genocide in Palestine.
Yeah.
And they all met the San Francisco City Council. They were all wrapped in the Palestinian garb.
Yeah.
They were all queer plus, all white. They all had masks on, which is something we need to be talking about more. Why are people still wearing masks? Because the government told them 2-4 years ago. And they were dancing around like wild cult members. I mean, it looked like something out of the People's Temple. Yeah. And to your point, San Francisco looks like freaking Mad Max objectively. And they don't seem concerned about that. But Palestine, man, you know, so yeah. I think it almost sounds like I'm ridiculing here, but I think there's an important thing for us to hone in on, and that is the disconnect from reality that this systematic propaganda has driven them to.
Okay.
How can you be in Chicago and San Francisco and your number one concern be Palestine to like a rabid fervor? You know, it's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
Mass formation psychosis.
In the Chicago footage, like they were just so excited. Like they had won this huge symbolic battle. And so what you're bringing to light or shedding light on is that this is a web of information that has successfully and successively removed them from reality. We don't know how it's going to shake out. One way to counter that is to stand strong and give out counter information, right? But one step further, what about the legal processes of this? Just bringing in your kind of understanding of like what's going on here. There was on Twitter, and I don't know if it was beyond Twitter, like with Texas kind of throwing down with the Biden administration being obviously very weak and unable to do anything about it. And then a bunch of Republican governors kind of throwing in, there was a lot of chatter about secession and civil war and blah, 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 which is a lot of chest beating of people like who want vengeance. But I don't know, is that inevitably where it's going to lead? Or do you think that everybody is one, too comfortable, two, doesn't want to deal with that level of chaos that an actual successionary movement would afford? And like, how would the government operate through that?
Yeah. I'll start by saying I am not a secession guy at all. I'm not a civil war guy at all. I think the idea of a national divorce is just catnip for fired up people. If everybody slows down long enough to actually try and play it out logistically, you'll probably quickly realize it can't work. So, and I don't mean to speak so arrogantly there. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, please. I'm really interested in your opinion.
Yeah. My theory is that that could never work. So as a starting point, I'm not on those teams. We need to figure out how to repair and restore the America that was given to us 200 years ago. There's a lot of legal wrinkles that are very interesting, but to focus in on Texas real quick, I didn't write about that very much for several reasons. Number one, I strongly believe James's theory that we were being marched to another Jan 6th. And I'll go back to the legal thing in one sec, but I wrote relentlessly last year that the Truman Show programming has lost the American masses to such a level that if they don't get another event that can produce Jan 6 like imagery for, let's be honest, for them to porn out for the next 11 months, I believe they're going to lose the election even if Donald Trump runs. So with that in mind, and I love to play out these kind of contingencies because it helps you stay two laps ahead of the race. When I saw Texas start forming, I'm like, there it is. I even saw pictures of CBS at the pickup trucks again with the Confederate flags, the American flags, rah, go to Texas. And I'm like, shit, man, this is bad.
Okay.
James was really blowing that horn. I think he was right. Another reason I didn't write about that much is I would need to grapple with the legal mechanics for that to make much sense to me. Now, I understand that the argument is the federal government has failed in their duty to protect the border to such a level that it justifies, almost on like an emergency basis legally, Texas superseding their jurisdiction and going in and securing the border. It's my understanding that's the argument. If that's the argument, my retort to that would be it's way too subjective to work, because we always have to remember every tool that we create is a tool that can be used by the other side. So when a lot of people were pushing like censorship and stuff post 10/7, because all these heinous things were being said about the Israeli people, it was important to remind folks like, yeah, the stuff they said at the Sydney Opera House was objectively horrible. But guess what? The anti-racists think the things we say are white supremacy, and white supremacy is objectively horrible. So we have to be careful with the tools that we enter into the fray. Yeah. And the reality is immigration law is reserved to federal jurisdiction. And in fact, part of that is a buffer zone along the border, which is reserved to federal jurisdiction. Under the Supremacy Clause, federal law trumps state, period. You take those and put them on the table, Benjamin, and I don't understand what Texas was doing. But I didn't write threads in that direction either, because this is a unique situation that we've never faced before. And to some extent, do you reach a level of crisis where you do have to figure out how to do something on an emergency basis? When Biden is coming in and literally cutting back fences and razor wires while thousands are streaming into the gap he just created, I can understand why Texas did what it did, but I cannot think of any legal underpinnings that would support it, which should concern people. Because at that point, what are we doing? Are we just the mob that's showing up and going, our way's righteous? That's dangerous, man.
Okay. But so this is speculation, and do as many caveats as you need to do. I'm just curious about this. Yeah. Why would the Biden administration allow for this level of immigration, illegal immigration, some say invasion? And if you look at the numbers, yes, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty astounding. It's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem. I saw the number today and it dropped my jaw because I just recorded an unscripted on Substack and wrote a thread a couple of days ago analyzing this problem. And I was doing it all from my understanding of the numbers was about 2 million per year. Okay. Cause that was the number in 2021 and 2022. So I was looking at 2 million a year, and that's just captured. Okay. That's captured and counted. I hate the word experts because who are experts? A lot of people who study this stuff believe that the actual level of entrance is up to five times that, potentially 10 million per year.
10 million.
Operating on a 10 million per year, okay? 2 million we know for certain because they've captured and counted 2,200,000 last year. So if some people think it's, and that's just the ones they captured. If you've seen the videos of tens of thousands streaming through at night, pretty much across the whole border, I think basic logic dictates that that number's a hell of a lot higher than 2 million. Well, I saw the number for 2023 today, captured and counted. It was 3.3 million. So it went up 1.2 million from last year. Under that, well, that's obviously not everybody. I'm not sure that's 25% we're capturing. So the point of this ramble is our population is only 330 million or so, 350 maybe. So if we're allowing in 3 million up to 10, let's split the baby and go with five. In 1 year's time, we've added, what is that, a percent, over a percent of our population? In 7 years' time, we've added 10% of our population. 10% of our population are now non-tax-paying illegal aliens who are draining from the benefits. In California, they're now not only giving health insurance to illegals, I pay a shit ton for my family's health insurance, they've just added sex change operations. In Newsomville, you can get queer plus revolutionary surgery as an illegal alien in America. So as we continually focus on increasing the rights and benefits of them under this sympathy, nonstop sympathy vehicle, while not doing anything to bring them in, You look at all these blue bastions, New York, Chicago, LA, that announce themselves as sanctuary cities. Come, guys, we'll bring you benefits if you'll come. Simultaneously with this, Benjamin, we have a propaganda campaign that gets launched, what, early 90s? About the great replacement theory, right? What that did was a form of hatecraft. It made it so that when a American says, I'm not okay with 2 million illegal entrants per year at the border, you can turn around and go, well, you just want a white supremacy country. You don't want non-white people in this country. It doesn't matter if that's a black American saying that. They get hit with the same hatecraft because that prevents us from being able to grapple with the issues just like it does across all of these fronts. So this great replacement theory was created to be used as hatecraft so that anytime we spoke against it, we were painted racist. And the American people became so intellectually castrated that they couldn't break out of that. And so as a result, we went, what, 20 years? Just not talking about the problem. If you brought it up, you must be racist. Man, I butt horns. I rammed horns. And I won't go off on this because I don't know your relationship and it's not my place on your show. But I rammed horns with Kathy Young about this a year or so ago after the Buffalo shooting. Because after the Buffalo shooting, Kathy Young, David French, Obama, Hillary Clinton, all the Alphabet Network, CNN, they all ran the messaging that the reason Buffalo shooter killed those people is great replacement theory. All the crazy whites in America are afraid of the non-whites coming across the southern border, blah, blah, blah. It was all about racism, right? So I posted something. I was going back through materials from 20 years ago where they were the ones who created this message. You have articles talking about they will soon be replaced. 40 more years, the demographics will change forever. There's a book cover with Obama, got his hand around, what's his name? Jerry Carwell, what's his name? A media guy. But anyways, his book. And the whole book is about how in 20, 30 years, the demographics have changed so much. So in answer to your question, long-winded answer here, what is the goal? I think it becomes quite obvious. The goal has been to flood the system with illegal aliens to such a level that we eventually reach a point where the only rational thing to do is to try to figure out how to get them to feed back into the system that they're pulling from. And the most concerning aspect about this to me that nobody's talking about is birthright citizenship. Birthright citizenship ain't very complex. If you're born on American soil, you're an American, period. So we even have these citizenship factories happening in California where they're flying mothers from China, bringing them in, like late pregnancy mothers, bringing them into these birthing sending hotels, giving birth to American citizens. These are almost all Chinese citizens doing this, and then immediately flying back to China. They have no interest in living here, no intention on ever living here. They want the dual citizenship. And because they're born on American soil, they get that. I bring that up because it goes to show how birthright citizenship can be gamed. So let's go back to the illegal invasion. If we've got, let's play with 5 million per year coming in, okay? I saw in 2021 a card given out by Border Patrol, federal, Biden's people, that gave court dates to illegals in 2026 and 2027. So that was 5 and 6 years out. They were being released, given a court date 6 years out, and said, hey, we'll see you then for your deportation hearing. Obviously, none of them are ever coming back for the deportation hearing, but let's assume they do. 6 years down the road, they show up with a three-year-old child. And guess what? The three-year-old child's an American citizen. So deporting them is not an option. You can't deport citizens. When they show up to the judge and say, hey, judge, I'm sorry I came in illegally back in 2021, is the judge deporting the mother and father and leaving the child? Of course not. So we have to find a way to get all the parents to stay. What number are we talking about at this point? Now add in DACA, add in Dreamers. These were all programs intentionally designed to build that base of children citizens because once they're there, can't deport all the parents. So what's the final page of this book? We get to a point where our assets, let's just say national assets, are being drained by millions of individuals that are not putting back into the system. It becomes unworkable, starts to sound a lot like government control and equity, doesn't it? And at that point, even sane people who are against immigration, the pitch becomes, guys, we have no choice at this point. We have to find a way to make them taxpayers. We either come up with a quasi-citizenship status where they're required to pay, or we just make them full-fledged citizens. As soon as they're able to pay, you got to allow them to vote. And as soon as they're able to vote, guess what the propaganda campaign becomes? The moral versus the monsters, those evil, white, racist Republicans want to deport all you guys. Only the anointed in blue want you to stay. So in my opinion, I'm now realizing this has been the design and the blueprint my entire life. Oh. I think this goes back 90s, 80s, or maybe even before.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Is the word communism? What is the end game then? Why destroy America if you're not going to replace it with the American that you want, right? So why are they destroying America?
So I'll take a stab here. And I usually wouldn't go out on a limb on a live show like this, but I'll take a stab at this. So going back to who's pulling the trigger, who's pulling the strings behind the curtains of the Truman Show, right? I have started to press in those directions just for my own curiosity's sake. And the one place that I ended one night that was a mind-blowing moment for me was when I really started digging into the Weather Underground. And when I started digging into the Weather Underground and Bill Ayers and his ties back in the 60s, that was a radical group of domestic insurgents who branded themselves around Marxist revolution of democracy and capitalism to be replaced with overt communism by the collective. You can go back and read their manifestos from the 60s and 70s. They did not hide their intentions, and they used the word Marxist revolution over and over and over and over. Well, they then deploy a campaign of domestic terrorism across America, including pipe bombs. The night that three of them were killed in Greenwich, they were intending to bring a pipe bomb to a party of non-commissioned officers. They were going to kill dozens of military people with pipe bombs. This is their campaign of Marxist revolution. And they blew themselves up in the townhouse. The investigators would later say that there were so many explosives in that townhouse, had they all blown, it would have destroyed the whole block and killed dozens of people. A lot of Americans aren't even aware of that story. They've never heard the term Weather Underground in their life. And the reason for that is COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO was a government spying operation to go after this Marxist web. And to the Marxist revolutionaries' credit, they violated the hell out of their constitutional rights, their Fourth Amendment search and seizure rights, and how they spied and surveilled on these people. They did a lot of warrantless searches and whatever. As a result of COINTELPRO and these constitutional violations, almost every one of those people involved, the architects of Weather Underground, all walked, man. Like a couple of them did 3 or 4 years, but they had murdered people with pipe bombs. These are people who should have been in prison for the rest of their lives. I go back to that, and I'm not 100% convinced COINTELPRO wasn't a cover to get them all off, but let's set that tin hat, you know, foil theory aside and just say, okay, by sheer luck, COINTELPRO lets all these people walk. Interestingly, one set of adults, husband, wife, did not walk. They had a child. When they had that child, they were sentenced to prison. I think it was 6 or 7 years for this pipe bomb campaign. They dropped their child off to be raised by who? Bill Ayers and Bill Ayers' wife. You know who that child was? Chesa Bourdain, the state attorney, the prosecutor in San Francisco, that immediately started building all these, what do they call them? What's that fancy social justice word they use for it? But in essence, increasing crime in San Francisco, bail reform, shoplifting being decriminalized. And look at the results of that. The guy who did that, the mastermind of that in San Francisco, was raised by Bill Ayers because his parents were in prison for pipe bombs. Okay. The reason I'm hammering Weather Underground so much is as a result of COINTELPRO, they didn't go to prison. And in fact, instead of going to prison, they got cushy academic gigs all around our country. One taught in Berkeley, one taught at NYU, one taught at Wisconsin. All over the place, these same overt Marxist revolutionaries are now at all of our schools, our universities, their professors. Suddenly, they're preaching social justice. You know what Bill Ayers is doing today? He's big into Black Lives Matter. Wow, what a coincidence. 50 years later, he loves him some Black Lives Matter, which post 10/7, we've all come to realize is a Marxist revolutionary organization. So the point of me bringing this all up, is if you go back through these ties, I'm sure everybody remembers when Obama, it was either his first cycle or his second. There was a whole bunch of chatter online about, this is the quote, the Bill Ayers connections. The Bill Ayers connections were immediately blurred away with what? Hate craft. If you brought them up, you were racist. You just didn't want a black president for the first time ever. Well, no, Obama had been involved in Bill Ayers' network the entire time. And these are all Saul Alinsky disciples who all not only read, but studied and wrote college theses on Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, which was all about radicalizing the working class to achieve Marxist revolution. Hillary Clinton wrote her college thesis on Saul Alinsky's principles and how you can radicalize to bring Marxist revolution. And do you know what she called it? Democracy. That's in like 72. I think she wrote that. Obama, through I'm blanking on the name, but there was this initiative in Chicago, the blank Chicago Education Initiative or whatever. That is when Obama really hits the scene. And if you go back to those receipts and dig into them, you come to realize that the member Obama was sold as a community organizer. The community organizations he came up through was the web, the Saul Alinsky Rules for Radicals web created by the Weather Underground people back in the 60s that had been permeating in our culture for decades on end. It became the DEI apparatus. So let's talk about that real quick, if you don't mind me continuing.
No, please, 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 please.
DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. Get rid of the DI. Let's look at the E for a minute. Equity. What the hell does equity mean? Well, very briefly, let's contrast it to equality. We are a country founded on equality under the law. We are not treated differently because of immutables like skin color. Equity is the antithesis of that. It is state control of distribution in order to equalize outcomes. I love to talk about it with the baseball field analogy. In equality, we make sure that everybody goes up to the plate with the same equipment. You have the same chance to hit that ball, same training, same everything. Equity principles would demand that we go to the end of the game and equalize everything. It's not fair that Johnny struck out four times and Tom got four home runs. Let's give two of those home runs to Johnny. It's a silly example, but that is the difference, the heart of equity versus equality. Kamala Harris has an infamous speech in a mask, of course, where she says point blank, she's one of the only people who speaks honestly about this issue. She talks about, you can't get equality if everybody didn't start in the same place. Ergo, we need the government to make sure everybody ends up in the same place. So in my opinion, equity is a fancy term for communism that allows it to get in all the fancy cocktail parties. Because if you just simply say, let's go to communism, no more democracy. Well, no, America will, you know, cast you away. Where I'm going with all of this, how did equity become part of America's mandated state religion of DEI? Why are we all being forced to genuflect and broadcast and announce this word equity, equity, equity over and over? I don't support equity. I support equality, and equity is counter to equality. So I'm now wondering, what are the roots of the DEI vehicle itself? I was chatting with my father, big mentor of mine, and he was in a, I don't want to dox myself here, but he was in an Army vein defense contractor world, and he was involved in hiring and retaining. This is before I was born, 72, I think, 74 era. He told me that at his organization, they had racial quotas in their hiring and retention. And I asked him to explain it to me, because how did that not run afoul of civil rights law? And the way that he explained it to me was the quotas were not mandated. And what I mean by that was he was never told, you will hire a candidate with this skin color. What was done was there were high level criteria or percentages they needed to meet. This harkens us to ESG in the private sphere, right? We need 15% of our people to be non-white. So when you got to the hiring and retention, it wasn't you must hire a black candidate or a non-white candidate. It was, what's our ratio, guys? Are we there? Oh, we're not there? Well, we need to get there, don't we? And he said time and time again, he saw candidates of greater merit dismissed in order to meet these quotas. So if we go all the way back to the 70s and this shit is happening, right around the time of Weather Underground, man, maybe 8 years later, 9 years later, this becomes the DEI engine. Obama then drives it into this just mass mania of identity and trans activism and queer plus and all this identity stuff. We go from Occupy Wall Street in front of banks in New York in 2011 to pride floats in front of the same banks in 2018. We have pride celebrations in front of Lockheed Martin, most inclusive bombs in history. So in my opinion, Benjamin, everything that I just laid out does not point to a conclusive answer.
Yeah.
But these are the puzzle pieces,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah.
And the tragedy is we're not even allowed to talk about them. No one talks about them except for us scary disinformation guys on the dark web.
Yeah. There's
so that's the communism tie, in my opinion. I think it is a legit communist movement. Global capture for control and collective distribution. What's fascinating about it is, I tried to write about this the other day and it just wouldn't come out right. We need to look at this as a two-level operation, a high level and a low level. And what I mean by that is the word Marxism is really confusing people. The Andrea in Croatia and I talked about this a lot that night. The word Marxism is really confusing people because the heart of Marxism is obviously radicalizing the proletariat, right? Radicalizing the lower class, the workers against the establishment. That is at least what we're told is pure or bare Marxist doctrine. Some people have told me it's all bullshit from get-go, but let's assume it was legit. It was all about radicalizing the peasants against the establishment. We have a modern day Red Guard in America that lots of people call the Rainbow Guard. And I think it's a perfect term. These are the queer plus revolutionaries. The vast majority of these folks are legitimate Marxists. They have been brainwashed through our academic channels their entire lives. They are anti-capitalism. They believe it's evil and oppressive. They want to replace it with the collective. They are overt Marxists. They've been convinced that every foul thing in their life is a result of this oppressive structure.
Yeah.
And where I'm going with this all is, in my opinion, at the floor level, ceiling and floor here, the floor is a legitimate Marxist movement in that it is driven by largely fringe, disenfranchised youth who do truly believe they are saving the world from oppression. But the people driving the propaganda campaign are the world's elite, the folks who meet in Davos every year. So one of the things that's really weird is a lot of people are like, what do you mean it's Marxism? This is being controlled by Wall Street and the richest people in the world. I know. Because the people up at the top aren't interested in Marxism at all. They're interested in power and control, and they're using, through that hate craft vehicle, an ability to radicalize the bottom. But I think the central point from that is, it is a Marxist movement, but it's one that's being artificially directed from up high. It's an astroturf Marxist movement.
Okay. You brought up the cocktail parties and those as the vector of trend setting and maybe downstream effects such as policy and the behavior of the behemoth that we call the United States government, or even the global United States empire. And then, so you brought that up as a place where discussion might be able to happen or change might be able to happen. And then you also brought up that the events or the response to the events of October 7th exposed some fractures in the self-interests of a lot of the movers and shakers. So is it sustainable? Once Israel, it'd be really funny if Israel turns out to be the piece that completely destabilizes this entire unified power structure.
It would almost fit, right? What is weird though is, and again, that's what I was saying with that before and after times of 10/7. Nothing changed on 10/7. The only thing that changed the next morning was a whole lot of people entering the chat that we had been trying to have for many, many years. Just suddenly the hate craft shield didn't keep everybody out except for scary Trump voters.
Yeah.
But it didn't change, man. And a lot of the rhetoric we're seeing from Summers, from Bill, what's his name, who was really hammering Harvard for a while, a lot of it falls so flat with me, Benjamin, because where were they?
Yeah.
You know, I was hammering... Not to get off track here, but I was hammering the FAIR organization and the FIRE organization the other day because they're like, they've almost become untouchable as these, you know, these illustrious defenders of free speech.
Yes.
And don't you dare allow our schools to become indoctrination centers and political hubs and all that shit, right? Where were you when this Marxist capture happened in our schools? Where were you when Harvard was writing abolish the white race 22 years ago? Where were you when these hordes of Rainbow Guard were chanting F off Nazi at all these campuses like Purdue? Where were you when people couldn't even call a man anymore on a significant portion of our college campuses? Now, oh my God, let's not let the schools get politicized. Dude, look at the teachers unions. Are they political? So I'm a little bit frustrated by where we are, Benjamin, because on one hand, I do think the post 10/7 unmasking is going to crumble this whole machine. And so I'm eager to keep pushing that. But at the same time, it chaps my ass, man, because the words are just very hard to take sincere because where you been? So no, I don't think it's sustainable. I think it is in a grand collapse. I think we are in a grand collapse. I also think there's a good chance Team Blue wins the election based off abortion and our democracy, even with the collapse ongoing around them, which is a troubling concept. Well, happened in 2022, right? I think.
Sorry, what?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I was just saying, 2022, there was a similar dynamic. We all thought, even the pundits on the left thought there was going to be this massive wave coming. I wrote about it a shit ton. I was pretty confident. And I was right, by the way. The red wave hit exactly like I thought it would in one state, my state. Didn't happen anywhere else, right? And why not? Abortion and our democracy propaganda. Okay. Well, guess what's going to get fired up here in the next 6 months? Abortion and our democracy propaganda. And I think there's a really good chance the DNC retains power in November. And if they do, they will continue pushing the equity agenda. Their base appears to be fine with that. So I think a lot is lurching or you know, is in the lurch for November. And I guess we have to ride with Donald Trump.
My democracy.
One thing I wanted to mention was, I think the thing that concerns me most when we go back to that, when I was talking about what is the off-ramp for these folks mentally, going back to my piece that I wrote, Web of Lies, one of the most important questions I think we need to answer as an American people, and this should cut across every camp, and the fact that it doesn't, maybe even more unnerving, is who is our media serving at this point? And the most poignant, it should shake everybody out of it, example was when the race-based admissions case happened. When was that? Last summer. Race-based admissions, so skin color discrimination for college admissions, is not supported in any camp at a majority basis in any of our 50 states. It is not even supported by in the darkest of blue regions at a majority level. And that's not my theory. We have evidence that this is true, and we can prove this definitively true by zooming in on California. California was the first state in the nation to pass a constitutional amendment that prohibited skin color discrimination in the admissions process. Yeah. This was back in the 90s, early 2000s. In 2020, Governor Newsom and his anti-racist zealots tried to push an initiative to overturn that or re-amend the Constitution to allow skin color discrimination. It lost at either 57 or 67% vote. It got steamrolled. So that proves that skin color admissions is not supported even in one of the darkest blue states. The DNC base does not support that at majority level. On the red, I doubt 5% do. And yet, across every news outlet, even our own president, Joe Biden, across every Democratic politician, the narrative was put forward that that ruling was another sign of a captured Supreme Court, fascism descending on America, white supremacy and racism, the overtaking, the end of our democracy, right? Who are they writing that story for? They're not writing it for Team Red, that's for sure. And I just proved to you definitively, not my own theory, that they're not writing it for Team Blue. Who are they writing it for, Benjamin? Who is our fourth estate serving at this point, right? Lab Leak screams here. Lab Leak is screaming here. So that concerns me more than anything. When we go back to, is there a shadowy cabal? Or is this just bumbling idiots taking advantage of opportunities? Are we able to put the story of race-based admissions in the latter bucket? I don't think we can. There's something else going on.
I'm no great student of history, which is a mark on my character, dark mark on my character. But
I wouldn't have known that. You're pretty intelligent. On
you look about stories around Chernobyl. You look at the stories around the USSR and its later stages, where the power structure is the power structure is the power structure. It's becoming more and more obvious that it's there to serve itself. But they just get disconnected from reality. Like, the truth has to be denied at every level. And so...
Point.
Right? So if... It, could it be the case that the media, the mainstream media, the legacy media, its sole job at this point is to facilitate the reification of the people in power and not to give them true information so that they can maintain their vision, right?
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. That's sort of, I like to come up with that. Can we come up with benign explanations for things we think are batshit crazy? And that is a good point, that you could just have a media apparatus that is passionately on Team Blue. Principles have been completely cast aside, and we are going to report in a way that favors our team.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, you look at the response to the Claudine Gay incident, where all of a sudden the left or the mainstream was just like, plagiarism doesn't matter at all. There's just like, they're sacrificing honesty, right? They're openly sacrificing their virtues for their team. And yeah. So that just, it's not stable. But that doesn't mean that it's not incredibly dangerous on the other side of
it. It is. Because once you're at the ends justify the means, we're in a bad place. And I'm seeing a lot of ends justify the means rhetoric coming out of the right now. The more empowered, emboldened right is pushing a lot of that rhetoric.
Yeah.
The left has pretty much lived on it for 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
The 1+1 equals civil war there, man. Now, I'm not a civil war guy,
yeah,
but we need to change that trajectory because the ends does not justify the means.
Okay, well, one push back to James. So James Lindsay, with regard to the state thing, the state versus the federal government, the Texas versus the federal government thing, he was really hammering hard that this is an OP, that they're looking for the optics, that this is a perfect opportunity for them to cast out and delegitimize Trump, full stop, delegitimize any dissidents, full stop, because they are insurrectionists. And a lot of pushback to James was, well, so don't do anything, just never do anything. And James was like, keep on pushing and pushing and pushing, and then it will collapse really quick. What if that's now? And what if waiting isn't the right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's some
validity to
that.
If the radicals are going to take every opportunity to advance, and the only pushback to that is any disturbing of them, they're going to think we're their enemies and they're going to go crazy. So we should never stand up. We should just do pure propaganda all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I see what you're saying. I mean, I think there's some validity to that.
I'm not saying it's not dangerous. I see that critique. I see the critique. It's like, okay, so
I do too.
How many millions is enough? How many gender mutilated children is enough? What's an acceptable number?
Yeah, I agree with you. You hit it on the head. It's a dangerous slippery slope.
And yes.
Not slippery slope. It's a very easy to cross threshold where it becomes counterproductive. And what I mean by that.
Okay.
Go back to. It was maybe November or December of this year when some new evidence came out about Hunter's laptop and Joe Biden corruption, whatever. Donald Trump posted on Truth Social. He posted something along the lines of, with this evidence that has come out, it is clear that it was fraud. The only proper thing to do is either declare that election invalid and declare me the president, or declare the election invalid and immediately hold a new election. Okay, this was 2 months ago he wrote this. Jack Posobiec and all the typical cast of characters jumped on that, trumpeted it to full bore. Jack then targeted at Ron DeSantis, quoted that, and basically said, Ron DeSantis is such a, you know what? He would never have the balls to say something like this. And I lost my shit because it's like, Jack, we have a real election that's coming in 10 months. The way to save this country would be to convince enough of America to vote for the team that's going to stop the equity program, not to go all in on let's piss on the Constitution, invalidate the election and hold one today. How about we campaign for the one that's in 10 months? So I guess my point is, I agree with you, Benjamin. There's validity to the critique, but boy, you push those buttons and it very quickly becomes the caricature that the left needs to win.
Okay.
They need the right to be these authoritarian fascists who are willing to stomp all over the Constitution to keep power. It's propaganda 101 because
that's what they are, though. That's what they are.
Exactly. Propaganda 101. Accuse the other side of that which you were doing. I could talk about that. If you don't mind me sharing one thought about law, because I meant to share this with you earlier when we were talking about Texas. I do think the legal channel is going to ultimately be our salve. And we are seeing that in the hospitals with the gender transition. We're seeing it a little bit on vaccine and COVID pushback, not as much as I'd like. But one of the most interesting developments is happening in courtrooms, and it's not getting any attention. And that is the gender dogma that is showing up in court opinions. One of the greatest examples of this was last year when Florida moved to block gender transition surgery, gender mutilation surgery of children and drugs of children in Florida. There was a federal judge, not coincidentally, the same judge who wrote the opinion in the seminal case in Florida that was going to make same-sex marriage lawful, that was paused or stayed until, what's the famous case, Oberfall, I'm terrible about pronouncing the name. When the federal case came down and it made same-sex marriage lawful, that rendered the Florida decision moot. Okay, so he never actually had to enter the opinion, but he was about to enter the opinion that was going to make same-sex marriage lawful. It becomes important to understand his background to then understand what he did in November. In November, or maybe a few months before that, when we moved to pass that state law, so that's the power of the people, that's the will of our people. We want to ban this, just like we don't let children go in strip clubs, we don't let them get tattoos, they can't buy alcohol. There's a lot of things you can't do with your kids as parents.
Yeah.
And we decided giving them drugs to sterilize them and cutting off healthy body parts would be one of those things. A federal judge entered a ruling down here that stayed that entered emergency injunctive relief against that, said that the law was unlawful. But most importantly, in his opinion, he wrote, and I quote, gender identity is real. Okay. That is a dogmatic statement. I do not believe that gender exists separate from sex. That's all states of the mind. So in my opinion, no, it's not real. It's also, and I won't get off track here, but it's also, in my opinion, Queer Plus dogma was specifically created to stand contrary to Christian doctrine. So it's also dogmatic positions that run contrary to the beliefs of the majority of our people, not just the religious, a majority of Americans are Christian. So here is a judge putting in a ruling, a statement of fact that is a dogmatic position that defies the fundamentals of Christianity, okay? He also quoted suicide stats that have been debunked for like 5 years now. Yeah, if we allow this ruling, they're all going to kill themselves, right? No, they're not. Just propaganda. Reminds me of Sotomayor blasting COVID fear porn from the bench. He wrote in that in order for him to enter an emergency injunction, he had to show that the case had a reasonable chance of winning on the merits at trial. He summarily decided that with one sentence in his order, knowing damn well that that case was never winning at trial. As a result, he is breaching the jurisdiction of the court. They don't have the right to suspend a law unless they think it can win at trial. Of course, it was ultimately overruled because it was unconstitutional as hell, but it went to show you how these ideologues intend on using our legal channels to subvert our will, even once the agenda has lost the will of the people. And if you understand Derrick Bell, if you understand Kimberly Crenshaw, if you understand where critical race theory came from, how it was always a legal theory about attacking and usurping our courts, this method of attack makes perfect sense. We just had the same ruling show up, and I think it was Colorado, Missouri or something. Same thing. Judge jumped in and said, no, your state law cannot be enforced because gender identity is real, inclusivity, DEI spells, woo, from the bench. So I think that is a microcosm of where this culture war is ultimately going to land. It's going to fall down on the seam of states' rights. I've been saying that consistently since I created my Twitter account. My pin thread is the Substack piece on that exact point where this collapses down on, and that state rights battle will ultimately be won or lost in the courts.
So
not enough people are talking about the courts. That's where this battle will be won or lost.
If the Ivy League, or let's say the blue law schools, are opening their admissions and lowering their test scores to get in the right kind of genetic makeup, I guess is what they want, but in the process sacrificing their uh, the the alacrity, the mental acuity of their workforce, and the red-leaning law schools, if there are any, don't play that game. Is it possible that that will end up, like, equity will end up blowing up in the face of Team Blue because it's producing shitty lawyers, shitty judges?
Yes, I think we're seeing that in the arts already. I think we're seeing that with like Disney films and stuff, right? They're just sort of collapsing because they're producing this copy pasta for that one troop and nobody else.
Yeah.
Law is an interesting industry, Benjamin.
It's precedent. So ideas can permutate once they get lodged in there.
You betcha. As soon as you can get the rulings in place, you bet, stare decisis, they become binding for everybody else. That is analogous to what's happening in the scientific and academic world with publishing. You have a bunch of gender ideologues who publish to build foundation for future gender ideologues, and then it becomes science. Yeah. You do have a similar concept in law, but law is a very interesting industry. I was just talking about this over the weekend. As lawyers, we are trained to distill facts down to the law. Put differently, we are trained professionally to operate in the realm of objectivity. The light was either red or green, and liability on this case is going to be determined on whether the light was red or green. Our job as lawyers is to prove definitively to the judge or the jury that the light was green or red, and we do that with facts and evidence. The dogmatic words of inclusivity and diversity and white supremacy and all that shit, it has no bearing in a courtroom. It has no meaning. We work with the objective. So as a result of that, if you think about it, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, it's just the nature of the lawyer mind and the lawyer training. We are largely impervious to a lot of that emotional manipulation with all these progressive spell words. It's not coincidental that the front lines of the COVID battle was chock full of lawyers, and it still is. Because we were able to see that the dogma made no sense, and that's because we are so accustomed to operating with facts. And the reason that I'm sharing all that with you is as a result of that, the legal industry has largely been a bulwark against woke capture. And I know a lot of people will probably be surprised to hear that because you see a lot of the like the DEI initiatives at the big firms in New York and stuff. You're like,
Supreme Court justices can't even say what a woman is without referring to the proper expert.
She thinks you need to be a biologist to be a woman, and she wrote lived
experience. Well, a certain biologist, I'm sure. She would select biologist to listen to.
Exactly. She wrote lived experience in a SCOTUS opinion. So we now have 2 + 2 = 5 on the bench, but yet we're told the right is doing an ideological capture of the bench. Propaganda 101.
Wow.
But there has been this resistance, at least in my experience down here in Florida, and maybe it's biased because I'm in state of freedom right now. It's not the same down here. I get that. But I am telling you, man, at your typical water cooler, at your big firm, this DEI inclusivity crap does not get any play. If you walk in a big law firm and start talking about all these dogmatic positions and oppression and equity and all that crap, the people who have cases to win tomorrow are going to look to you like you are crazy. So culturally, it's had a tough time taking over the law firms because we've been trained to push that crap out. So I think that's a really good thing here is that I know a lot of people don't agree with this theory. They feel like the law world's already captured. And I agree they're trying hard to capture it because that is the end game, final boss of capture. They're not going to do it. Law is going to be the first industry that tells these people to pound sand. And you're already seeing it. Some of the big firms have already come out kind of like that AI guy did from Silicon Valley when he said, you're breathing the vapor of a new religion that is destructive and wrong, and you are not welcome at my company. You're starting to see that type of rhetoric from some of the law firms in the after times, post 10-7. They're going, oh, wait a minute. We don't want these indoctrinated zealots at our firm. Again, makes my face turn a little red because it's like, why did you not have this problem on 10-6?
Yeah.
But yeah, man, we are an interesting bulwark against all this. I think lawyers will largely help.
Yeah,
end this.
That's nice to hear because I was trying to like angle the conversation to like a positive vision. So that's something slightly positive, something that like leavens the pill of blackness that we're feasting on today.
Absolutely.
But
the most positive. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No. What is that? What is the positive vision? then.
Sure.
That the is, most positive that is, thing. That is enshrined in law and that can be reified through law. What is the positive vision?
Quality. Quality under the law is going to be ultimately what gets us out of here, because equality, again, is antithetical to the notion of equity. It reads better the other way. Equity is antithetical to equality under the law. That's just a statement of fact. If we have policies of equity that discriminate on skin color, we would call that moral discrimination. Moral discrimination is prevented by our Civil Rights Act. So
yeah, but it's practiced all the time. Like correct. With California, the California schools, like, okay, we're not going to do that. And they just keep on doing it. Harvard's just going to keep on doing it. They're going to keep on
doing it.
Because
it makes... Going back to how DEI came, where we were talking about that weather underground and everything, how do we get to a point of affirmative action and moral discrimination policies as federal law? How did that not always contradict the Civil Rights Act? Yeah. Because equity became this magic spell. But let me end a non-legal positive thought, a white pill at the end of this talk. And that is the future, the salve is the next stage in the cycle, capital T, capital C. Hard times create strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. We are just coming out of a period of the weakest men in American history. Half of them think they're females. And as a result of the weak men everywhere, we have been put through some really hard times. Frickin' goods are locked up in stores. Black Lives Matter riots burn down cities. Gender queer plus everywhere. Immigration. The economy's faltering. We are in some truly hard times. The good news is the cycle always completes. And the hard times become like a blacksmith fire that forge the next generation of strong men, which means women too, for people who don't like that phrasing. I am seeing
the
that
weak
in
people
my
out
daughters.
There.
Yeah, sorry. Exactly. For the weak people who can't stand the way I phrase that, I do mean women too. But my point in that, Benjamin, is I am seeing that rebirth in my daughter and her friends and her generation. Again, qualified by the fact we're in Florida, and I get it's a little different animal down here.
Yeah.
They are rejecting this darkness, this oppression, this America sucks mentality. My daughter doesn't want anything to do with that. She is able to identify it. She sees it as almost a, I don't want to use the word evil because I don't teach her in a good evil framing. She sees it in a destructive vein, in a, I don't want to run with those people anymore. I walked into a coffee shop recently and there was a leftist as heck girl at the register and she looked miserable. I mean, she just looked miserable before I walked up to her, projecting misery. And I called her ma'am, like I do with everybody. I'm just sir, ma'am, army son. Yes, ma'am. You know, I like that. Yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am. By the third or fourth time I called her ma'am, her entire demeanor changed. And I'm not saying this to make this up or be cheesy. Her posture changed. She sat up more. She called me sir. We ended that interaction with, have a good day, sir. You too, ma'am. I appreciate your help. And I walked out of there and I thought, dude, this is the way. Yeah. We need to stop highlighting the wrong and start highlighting the right. Meaning if our way is, I don't mean righteous as in better than you, but we're building a foundation we think's good here. Then let's show the youth why it's good instead of keeping pointing out all the reasons why it's bad.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing that in my daughter, that wave will save us.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to make fun of your Twitter because it's just putting out all the bullshit. But you do leaven it. You do leaven it. Yeah,
I do. I also, just as an FYI, I go to Mass. I'm not a believer, by the way. I just think it's a good place for my family to be. Huh. My wife's very Catholic, so I don't mean we ended up there, but we go to the oldest cathedral in Florida or in the country. It was the first place Catholicism landed on American soil. Oh, it's a cool town. St. Augustine is walking, breathing history. It's an absolutely beautiful town. But the young priest there holds an event called Nightfire 4 times a year. And without getting long-winded on you, they open up the doors to non-parishioners. They turn all the lights off in the church. They go out in the streets and they ask people if they want to come in and light a candle. You don't have to commit yourself to Christ or anything. Just come in and light a candle.
Yeah.
They give out people these little candles, real flames. You get to walk up to kind of where the altar is and place one on. By the end of the night, there's probably 1,000 candles burning and it radiates the whole church. It's beautiful. They have the choir up there singing these chanting songs. I just like to go there and vibe. At Nightfire, the last 2 or 3 times, I have seen kids from Flagler. Now, Flagler College is similar to SCAD in Savannah, if you're familiar with that. It's an art design, very leftist college. I mean, the bulk of their students wear the political cloth.
Yeah.
I have seen groups of those kids coming into every Nightfire now. They look leftist as heck. These are not lifelong religious people. And I'm not telling you they're coming to the church. That's not the point.
Yeah.
The point is they're walking down the street and they're curious about what that light is in that building. They're curious enough to walk inside and light a candle. 2 years ago, Benjamin, they were laughing at that building and mocking it. I think that story tells us something profound. And I think it tells you that the next stage of the cycle is in transition. White pill.
This little light of mine.
That's right. I become like the salesman for the church. And it's really bizarre because I'm not part of the church, but I am like a salesman for it right now. But it's about values, right? Not scripture to me.
So people can, you have a Substack, you have a Twitter, looks like you might have something like a podcast, but it's under wraps or at least gated right now. Where can people go to find you? And also thank you very much for showing up tonight and just bringing me your just intense energy. It's just so fun.
You bet. Really enjoyable. You bet. I appreciated you having me, Benjamin. I hope I did a somewhat better job of not talking over you as much. I'm not sure. I'll have to go watch it back. I played back our first one and I'm like, man, I just talked all over that guy. But you do a great job of doing this. And again, I'm honored to be here. Substack is where you can find me. Twitter, obviously, Theo_TJ_Jordan on Twitter. There's a link to my Substack, theojordan.substack.com. I'm writing a lot of essays over there. And then again, I'm working on conversations, which are meant to be like fly on the wall conversations between hopefully interesting people.
Oh, great.
And then I'm doing, the idea is just instead of doing episodes of people, just firing the red light on and having friends over for a digital beer, recording it. If other people find it interesting, cool. And if they don't, that's cool too. And then I'm doing like unscripted, which are just sort of open mic rants. Last two quick plugs. I am about to launch my first ever visual project. Ooh. I'm going to do something called COVID Files. I'm going to create like 3 to 5 minute impact clips that run over some of the most important topics: transmission, natural immunity, threat level to children, the disappearing flu, adverse reactions, a whole lot of things that I don't think enough people in America understand how badly they were deceived. I want to boil down the studies and the receipts in visual form while I narrate on top of them.
Wow.
And then the last project I'm doing is Tales from the Academy. I'm trying to seek people who have firsthand insight to this queer plus Marxist takeover of our universities who are willing to share their stories either in writing or in person. And I'm going to try to assemble a composite of that that I think is going to tell a really important story.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. You know, I deal a lot, as you know, with the gender issue. And you know, one question that keeps on popping up is that what's going to happen when this is going to blow over and there's all those adults, the so-called adults in the room that were doing this or facilitating this? Are there anybody going to be held accountable? And the same thing can be asked about the massive power grab and around the pandemic and the response to the pandemic and who's going to. But is anybody like even just like low level, well-meaning medical professionals like that just went along with it? Like, and then you look at like the test scores, you look at all of these negative reactions that are going to balloon over time. Are they going to feel like, oh, maybe I should.
I don't know. Unless we can shatter the propaganda, I think the answer is no.
Yeah.
Because they're still trapped in the web of lies, and we're seeing the seeding already. I tangled with some doctor last night on Lab Leak. He's already laying the seeds for the excuses of, well, it wasn't the scientists that misled, the media misinterpreted.
Oh, right. That's a good play.
Yeah, the seeds are being sprinkled. I clowned that guy last night.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So I don't know, man. I don't know. The Helen Joyce clip where she talks about the transgender parents being like that soldier on the Japanese island who wasn't aware the war was over 10 years ago, that was bone chilling. And I think she's absolutely correct. And that kind of goes back to that lost generation. I mean, on one hand, what do we do to save these kids? But on the other hand, Benjamin, I'm sort of at the point that I don't want to spend my energy there anymore. I want to save the next wave of like 9 and 10 year olds and make sure they don't end up in the same place.
For sure. For sure. Excellent. Thank you very much. I got to bounce to cook dinner for the family. Theo,
absolutely.
Thank you so much. I'm going to have you back on. Maybe we'll get a third person on because it's just so fun to tangle with you.
Awesome. I love it. Thanks so much for inviting me, Benjamin. Look forward to talking to you soon, brother.
My pleasure. All right. Peace.
We are the music makers. And we are the dreamers of dreams. Mm-hmm.